From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, director Brian De Palma talks with us about his controversial new film, Redacted, based on a true story of the rape and murder of a 14-year-old Iraqi girl by U.S. soldiers. The film uses fictionalized video diaries, documentaries, and web postings to tell the story. Also, Army Chaplain Father John Barkmeyer tells us about helping soldiers deal with stress, fear, loneliness, and the pain of losing friends in combat. He's serving a 15-month tour in Iraq, where he travels by military convoy to remote outposts, performing mass, serving last rites, and counseling troubled soldiers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Brian De Palma has been making films and generating controversy for more than 40 years. His work includes the thrillers Dress to Kill, Body Double, and Blowout, as well as Scarface, Mission Impossible, Snake Eyes, and his biggest miss, The Bonfire of the Vanities. De Palma's latest project is Redacted, a troubling war story set in Iraq. It's based on a 2006 incident in which a group of American soldiers raped a 14-year-old Iraqi girl, then murdered her and her family. The story is remarkably similar to De Palma's 1989 film Casualties of War, based on a rape and murder by American soldiers in Vietnam. In this scene from Redacted, a soldier who was in the unit but did not participate in the attack shares his feelings with his father, also a military man, in a video phone call.
Dad, something happened. Something really, really horrible. And you knew who was responsible. Isn't it your duty to say something?
What did you do?
I didn't do anything. I didn't do a damn thing. A couple of my buddies...
Members of your squad?
Yes, sir.
I hope you realize how serious the situation could be.
Yes, I do realize.
We don't need another Abu Ghraib.
I understand that, sir, but...
I mean, if your brother's screwed up, that behavior reflects on the whole Corps.
There was a crime, sir. I think charges should be brought.
Son, listen to me. Do you know the first thing to come into question in a court-martial on a thing like this will be your sanity?
My sanity?
That's right. Your sanity for bringing charges like this.
In the incident Redacted is based on, four soldiers were prosecuted and sentenced to prison. A fifth, who is now a civilian, still faces charges. The film has received attention as much for an editing controversy as for its content. De Palma ends Redacted with actual photos of dead Iraqi civilians, but the producers of the film blacked out the eyes and some faces of the victims, citing concerns about potential lawsuits. De Palma publicly condemned the move, accusing the producers of redacting his film out of cowardice. I spoke to Brian De Palma earlier this week. Well, Brian De Palma, welcome back to Fresh Air. You're an accomplished visual storyteller, and it's interesting that in this film, the narrative is conveyed through a series of devices. I mean, a soldier's video journal, a French documentary, security cameras, which seem to capture some action. Why did you choose to do it that way?
Because that's how I found it. I was approached by HDNet to make a movie for $5 million on anything I wanted. It just had to be shot in high definition. So I said, that's fine if I could think of something that was best realized in high definition. And then I read about the incident that the movie is based on. And I said, my God, this is Casualties of War all over again. And I didn't want to use straightforward, dramatic, traditional storytelling techniques. And in the process of researching the material, I came across all these unique visualizations on the internet, whether they be blogs or websites or montage of casualties, soldiers' wives, postings, rants. I found all those forms on the internet, and I thought, well, this is the best way to convey this story, which I told before in Casualties of War.
Well, now you wrote and directed this film, which is based on this true incident of American soldiers who raped and murdered an Iraqi teenage girl. But, of course, how you choose to portray the GIs is a huge decision and very loaded given, you know, all of the opinions about, American troops in Iraq. And I thought we'd listen to a clip from the film. This is a clip of a couple of soldiers, and this is captured on a security camera in the film. But the occasion is that one of a member of their unit has been blown to pieces by an IED, an improvised explosive device. And they're venting their fury and their reaction to this incident. Let's listen.
Man, they don't want to kill us over there in the good old U.S. of A. I mean, they do, but they can't. It's too f***ing hard right now. Man, they want to kill us here. On their turf. In their f***ing country. Yeah. Where every turn is the wrong turn.
Every single one of them knew where that f***ing IED was.
Damn right.
You don't see them stepping on it, do you? No. They just sit in their f***ing backyard drinking their f***ing tea, waiting for one of us to bring the
Saying six, leaving five.
Come on, boys.
Well, guess what? That ain't gonna happen no more. Hell no! There's gonna be one big bitch of a preemptive strike.
Yeah.
We're gonna be torching every last Johnny Jihad.
Later.
And there ain't gonna be nothing left but scorched earth.
And that's from the film Redacted, directed by my guest, Brian De Palma. You know, I think that's probably a very different image than most people have of GIs serving in Iraq. I mean, I think most people think of service people there as kind of confronting a bewildering situation and just wanting to get home. Here we see a lot of rage directed at Iraqis. You know, there are atrocities in all wars. Do you think that this is a film about what war does to people in general or a particular kind of war?
Well, this is a war with no reason. And when you put soldiers in situations where they're fighting for no discernible reason, and the only thing that keeps them going is the fact that they're protecting their buddies, and then their buddies are killed by maybe one of those people out there that they don't understand, and they're not sure whether they're an insurgent or a civilian, this is where this kind of a rage erupts. But like Casualties of War, this particular story, as sorrowful as it is, to me, is basically what we do to these people. We destroy their country, we destroy them, in order what was the expression in Vietnam, destroy the village to save the village. This is what we've done, basically.
In your director statement for Redacted, you said that when you'd read about this incident in Iraq where these soldiers raped and murdered this young girl and members of her family, you were very troubled by the question, how could these boys have gone so wrong? Where did you look for an answer to that question?
The question was answered in Casualties of War, and it was the same situation. It's not a difficult question to answer. Once you consider the circumstances under which these things happen. And the thing about my movie is it tries to show how, you know, basically decent individuals can go so wrong. But it also includes the fact that in situations like this, you need one wild card. You need one guy that is different than anybody else, that takes it much farther than any normal person would. And that is very much based on a lot of, you know, incidents I've studied over the years, whether they be in Cold Blood or the Oblonsky murders. I mean, you can't get a group of people to do something as horrendous as this unless you've got one sort of crazed leader.
Right, and in both films you see that. One,
yes.
One who...
And in this film it's even more extreme because the character from the actual incident was going to be, you know, removed from the army because he had psychological problems, and it also goes to the fact that they're recruiting people that they would not normally recruit.
You know, it was interesting when I looked back at some of the reaction of veterans groups to Casualties of War when you released it in 1989, and there was some negative reaction, but not all of it. And I wonder if any of the reaction that you received to that film affected the way you portrayed GIs in Redacted.
No, because I think it's essentially the same situation. You've got boys over there that don't know why they're there. When you're fighting a war and killing other people, you better have a very good reason. You're in a completely alien environment. You're like you're on Mars. You don't understand the culture. You don't understand the language. You don't understand the people. You're living in extremely hostile environment. The only thing that keeps you sane is the fact that you have other guys there with you. And then, of course, somebody gets killed right next to you. And then you just turn all your anger on the all those people out there that could be complicit in this particular catastrophe.
You know, one of the ways that in this film you show the interaction between GIs and Iraqi civilians is a very close and intimate look at a vehicle checkpoint, which the soldiers in this unit that you're following are operating. And you see these, you know, Iraqis arriving both on foot and in vehicles and how they're treated by the Americans. I'm wondering, if you could say a little bit about creating that scene in that checkpoint, where you drew that?
Well, that, of course, is based on stuff I saw posted on the internet in documentaries. And then there was a lot of information I had to convey about the statistics about what happens at these checkpoints. And of course, you know, a lot of people are accidentally killed all the time. And I decided to convey this in this very stylized pseudo-French documentary because I wanted to slow everything down. Because one of the things that's difficult to do on film is to show how slow and boring everything is, because that's what happens when you're stationed at a checkpoint like this. It's endlessly boring, and it's hot, and it's uncomfortable. And you've got, you know, over 100 pounds of equipment you're carrying around, and it's just an unbearable way of living day in and day out. And then suddenly something violent happens and everything goes crazy.
Right. Do you want to say a little bit about the incident that occurs on? I don't know if it gives away part of the plot.
That, of course, is based on numerous incidences at checkpoints where, in this case, a guy rushing his sister to the hospital can't understand the signs because many Iraqis are illiterate. Don't understand people waving at them, to stop. They think, maybe that's high. And, he's trying to get to the hospital, and he crosses the trigger point, and then he's immediately shot, and his pregnant sister is killed.
Right. You know, and there's a moment after the killing at which the soldier who's keeping a video diary talks to the guy who had shot the young woman, and at that point it's clear that it was a mistake and that an innocent person had been killed, and he asks him how he feels about it. And among the things he says, apart from using some racial insults to describe Iraqis in general, he says, it was like gutting catfish. Waxing Hajis is like stomping cockroaches. It makes me thirsty.
Exactly material from the guy that was involved with it that I had to rewrite because I couldn't use his exact words.
You mean the guy that was involved in the murder and rape, the leader of this?
Absolutely, right. Absolutely.
So you were really capturing a real sense. And I guess
I was constantly forced to change what the guy actually said because the guys were being prosecuted at the time, and I couldn't use their real quotes.
But they were.
So I came up with something very similar to it.
You know, but I guess one of my reactions as I sat in the film was, as I look at this as people who, you know, in America, even people who hate the war support the troops, and we regard them as people who are doing their best to in a tough situation. And when they see a soldier behaving this way, talking, you know, in such a sort of ruthlessly sadistic manner about the people he's interacting with, I can just see people saying De Palma is slandering our troops. Did that concern you at all?
Well, obviously you're going to get reactions like that, but the fact is that that's dialogue is absolutely quoted and changed, not to make it, you know, more vicious or it doesn't, you don't have to change it to make it more vicious. What the guy said was vicious enough, and of course they referred to the Iraqis in pejorative terms. I mean, you know, to have a pejorative name for, you know, the people that you're fighting is not unusual among soldiers.
Right, right. No, it's more the sort of sadistic, almost pleasure that in which he talks about killing them. That I guess. And again,
well,
I don't.
He doesn't. He's offended by the way he's being sort of pushed around. He's being pushed by, you know, the moralist in the group. Hey, you know, what am I supposed to feel? I mean, you know, this is what I'm supposed to do, right? And we had a real Sarge in the group there, and the Sarge said, yeah, that's right. They cross the trigger point, you shoot them. That's what we're supposed to do, so go to bed and shut up.
Right, and it's wrong to say he took pleasure in it. It was more an indifference to it. I
mean, he doesn't know what he feels.
Right.
He's confused. I mean, you know, he's a little sassy about it, you know, because he's trying to be kind of masculine in front of the guys. But this is an evolving character during the piece. I mean, you know, You know, and when he gets sort of, you know, cornered, then he sort of kind of lashes out.
Our guest is Brian De Palma. His new film is Redacted. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is film director Brian De Palma. His latest film, which is involves an incident of American troops murdering and raping an Iraqi teenager, is called Redacted. Well, you know, you had a very public battle with the producers of the film Redacted about the still photographs which come at the end of the film, but before the credits. Tell us first what these pictures were and your purpose in putting them at the end of the film.
Well, again, this is something I discovered on the internet. If you put Iraq war casualties, you'll come up with these montages of very sorrowful pictures of, you know, people that have been killed, civilians, and with very sad music. And I said, my God, I got to put this in the movie. This is something that a form that I discovered on the internet. So then it occurred to me, well, why are only these pictures on the internet? Why haven't I ever seen them anywhere else? So I went to the people that were taking the photographs and I said, give me the pictures, you can't get published. And that's what became the montage. And the argument I got in with the company financing the movie is they knew right from the get-go that I was using real pictures. We got releases from the photographers. And of course, some of the pictures in the montage are staged because they're not from actual incidences. There's, you know, the pregnant women, that picture staged, and obviously the picture of the girl at the end is staged. So I could have staged all the pictures if I knew that I couldn't use the real pictures, but I thought it was very important. I tried to use as much real material as I could, but I was constantly frustrated by the lawyers saying, well, you can't use that because we need, you know, releases from, you know, dead babies and relatives of dead babies. They sort of,
right,
you know, sprung that on me in the ninth hour when obviously somebody up in the company saw the real pictures that were available, I would say, from January. Somebody actually saw them around June and said, oh my God, we can't have pictures like this in a movie we're producing. And that's when I got in the battle over the redaction of the pictures.
How did you learn there was a problem?
So I was told basically that the insurance would not cover the liability.
And your view is that there is no real legal issue here, right?
Exactly. Yeah. There is no real. I mean, we fought because I said I insisted that they violated my final cut, but we lost the case.
You know, this may be an utterly facile observation, but I wanted to get your reaction. I mean, when one looks at a lot of your earlier work, a lot of the thrillers that you made, they involved, you know, voyeurism and predatory violence towards women. And, you know, one might say, well, De Palma decides to make a film about the horrors of war, and what we see are two films about, you know, the murder and rape of a woman. Why were you drawn to these two stories?
This is a metaphor for our destruction of this country. We have raped and destroyed this country. That's the same thing we did to Vietnam. And then what do? We just leave.
You know, I just have to ask you this. I read that when you were a kid, that your mother asked you to do some surveillance work on your father because she suspected he was stepping out. Is this true?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And did you do it? What did you find? How did you do it?
I taped his phone conversations. I was a bit of a science whiz. I big science fair winner. And I used to follow him when he went to meet his girlfriend and take pictures.
Wow. So a piece of the of the voyeur filmmaker falls into place here. I mean, do you think that affected the movies? I mean, that...
Well, obviously your experiences affect the movies that you make. But, yeah, I made a movie, you know, Home Movies, that sort of takes this from a very comedic point of view and tells the story of, you know, a young guy following his father around when he's having an affair.
Well, I feel like I've gotten into a really intrusive area, but I have to ask. So what did you do with the pictures? What became of her concern?
I gave all the evidence, but I finally discovered my father with the woman, and that was sort of the end of my mother's and her marriage. And fortunately, my father went on to marry the woman he was having an affair with, and they were together for like 40 years. And my mother remarried a very nice guy, and they were together until he died, and then she died. So it was good what happened. They shouldn't have been together, and they found people that they loved and shared a better life with afterwards.
Although I have to
say,
it
has a sort of happy ending.
Right. Although it's kind of mind-blowing for a teenager to be the agent of something like that.
Yes, it is. But, you know, my mother was the one that sort of... got me involved. It certainly wasn't something I dreamed up by myself.
Well, Brian De Palma, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Brian De Palma's new film, Redacted, is in selected cities now and will open across the country on Friday. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Miramax Films, presenting the new Coen Brothers motion picture, No Country for Old Men, in select theaters November 9th, everywhere November 21st. From Bantam Books, publisher of The God Machine, From Boomerangs to Blackhawks, The Story of the Helicopter by James R. Childs. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, performing mass, taking confessions, and serving last rites in the middle of a war zone. We talk with Army Chaplain Father John Barkmeyer, who's serving a 15-month tour in Iraq. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. The job of a military chaplain serving in a war zone goes well beyond conducting religious rituals and offering spiritual counseling. Soldiers are beset by stress, exhaustion, fear, loneliness, and all too often the pain of losing friends in combat. A unit's chaplain is frequently the person a young soldier turns to for counseling and comfort. Our guest, Father John Barkmeyer, was pastor of a parish on Chicago's South Side before deciding to become an Army chaplain in 2003, the year U.S. and coalition forces invaded Iraq. There's a shortage of Catholic priests in the Army, and for much of his current tour in Iraq, Father Barkmeyer has been the only Catholic chaplain in the province of Anbar. I spoke to Father Barkmeyer recently when he was in Chicago for a brief R&R break. He left for Iraq today to complete his 15-month tour of duty. Well, Father Barkmeyer, welcome to Fresh Air. You were a civilian until 2003, is that right?
Correct, yes.
What got you into military service?
Well, I primarily was a pastor in the southwest side of Chicago, and a lot of the kids in the parish were volunteering for service, and especially between the Army and the Marines. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about supporting our troops, and, you know, most of that revolved around putting, you know, a yellow ribbon around on the bumper of your car and things like that. And I realized that there was a tremendous shortage of Catholic priests in the armed forces, and it was something that I could do that could be meaningful for lots of soldiers, Marines, sailors, and airmen. So because of that, I think that really piqued my interest and my curiosity, and that's what started the process.
Now, if I understand, you were the only Catholic chaplain in the Anbar province of Iraq, is that right?
The only Army Catholic chaplain, correct.
Right.
There were a couple of Navy priests in the area. But I'm the only Army chaplain.
So give me a sense of sort of how you minister to that many soldiers. How big the area is, how much you have to move around where you're stationed.
Sure. Okay. Probably the two principal things that I do. One is traveling from location to location, celebrating the mass worship services for guys. And the big challenge there is transportation. Trying to get anywhere is a major deal. The first thing is because you always have to travel in a convoy, and normally it's a convoy of at least 4 gun trucks. You may have anywhere between 12 to 15 personnel. So trying to get those kind of resources is very difficult. It's also then, depending on the area where you're traveling, you know, it can be fairly dangerous too. My second week at Ramadi, my Humvee was hit by an IED, a roadside bomb. And so, you know, that certainly got my attention, and it's always a little bit of a challenge, and always kind of wondering, anytime you leave the wire, anytime you go outside the gate of the camp, you know, what's going to happen? So transportation, traveling to the different combat outposts and the different bases or forward operating bases or FOBs is a significant part of the experience.
You said you travel around to a lot of forward areas, and you hold mass there. How do you physically manage that? I mean, where do you conduct mass in a forward area?
you conduct mass, you know, any place you can. The combat outposts tend to be like a building that the Army or the Marines will have taken over, fortified with sandbags, with blast walls and guard posts and things like that. The inside, of course, it's a very austere situation. There's never, you know, running water. At best, you've got electricity. So when it comes to saying mass, you say mass in any nook and cranny you can. What I use for an altar depends. You know, you can pop out the windshield, the bulletproof windshield on a Humvee, turn that upside down, put it on a couple of gas cans, and, you know, I've said mass on that. I've frequently, probably most often, I've said masses on litters, so on stretchers, just because it happens to be a flat surface. But you think about the symbolism of that. You know, these are stretchers that have, you know, no doubt carried injured, wounded, sometimes dead soldiers, and here I am, you know, celebrating the sacrifice of the mass and using that as the altar, and it's powerful and it's symbolic, and I don't think the soldiers miss that. You know, I think they understand that intuitively.
Now, as a priest, I assume you hear confessions also in forward areas.
I do, right. So, yes.
And how do you manage that physically?
Well, you go anywhere that's private. So sometimes you have to, you know, wander around a little bit and find a corner of a lot, corner of the building. But, you know, when a soldier says, you know, hey, can you hear my confession? You know it's going to be something important. And you do whatever you can to, you know, to accommodate that and certainly to ensure confidentiality and privacy.
Well, I know that you spent a lot of years you know, as a priest in, I guess, the south side of Chicago, are the confessions of soldiers in a war zone distinct from the confessions of civilians?
Oh, boy, they absolutely are. It's frequently, you know, life and death type stuff. The impact of having to kill another person, you know, even though it's clearly a combat environment, clearly something that, you know, under the just war tradition it would be morally justified, it still tears apart a human being. I just don't believe we're made to do that. You know, we don't do that naturally. We don't do that instinctually, and so having had those experiences of killing another person makes you think, you know, in terms of, hey, you know, what am I doing? What does God want me to do? It becomes all the more tragic when the individual realizes that it was a civilian that they killed inadvertently. It becomes devastating. And so it's very, very different. The confessions are very different than in civilian life.
And, I mean, I guess part of what you do in that role is prescribe penance. Do I have that right?
Correct. Yes, penance. You know, oftentimes we would ask the soldier, the Marine, to pray for the individual that they killed or wounded, or to pray for themselves, to ask for healing, from God. But that's an important part of the sacrament.
Catholic soldiers have the option of, when you come by, requesting a confession and can share these troubling thoughts. I'm sure a great many of the soldiers you meet are not Catholic. Do they approach you, or are there venues, are there ways for them to seek the comfort and guidance that you might give them?
You know, absolutely. The chaplains in the armed forces are the only folks that can offer complete confidentiality. So if somebody speaks to a chaplain, and this is regardless of their particular denomination or faith tradition, the conversations they have with chaplains are 100% confidential. And the Army does that because the military does that in order to give them a safe venue, a place to vent, a place to say things that they need to say that they couldn't otherwise. It becomes difficult for chaplains because, sometimes a soldier might say, I'm planning on killing myself, and there's nothing you can do. So as a chaplain, I've been put into a lot of uncomfortable situations, but the overall good...
Have you been told that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And boy, that's tough. So, I mean, I work with the individual as much as possible. What I'd like to, would certainly like to be able to do would be to go to their first sergeant or company commander and say, hey, look, this is the issue. We need to put them under suicide watch and so forth. But you just can't break confidentiality, and that's not easy.
Gosh, that must be a burden for you to carry.
It is. You're wondering, I wake up some days and the first thing I do is check up on a soldier. Is this guy still around? Is he okay? So it's not easy. It serves the ultimate good for the soldiers, but, in order for them to be able to talk through the issues that they need to talk through in a safe, confidential environment, but it does come at a price.
Well, in the civilian world, a counselor has a private office and someone can make an appointment and do that without their peers knowing that they're doing it, if they want to keep it private. I mean, how do you enable that in a combat setting?
Well, I'll tell you what, being deployed is like living in a fishbowl. There's very little privacy. I do have my separate room, so I do counseling in my own in my private room, and that gives people at least physically a place to go. But what frequently will happen is it might take place over the course of walking with somebody, sitting down at a meal, and I guess people around, they know what's going on. They may not know the subject of what's being discussed in the counseling, but they realize, hey, this guy's talking to a chaplain, and they look like they've got a pretty serious expression on their faces. They know what's going on, and that's part of being in military life, is you don't have that privacy, you don't have that type of those types of outlets you have in the civilian world. Everybody tends to be in everybody else's business, and that's probably why the confidentiality aspect that chaplains can offer is so important, because at least what's said remains a secret.
We're speaking with Father John Barkmeyer. He is an Army chaplain who has spent 10 months in Iraq and will be returning. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is Father John Barkmeyer. He is an Army chaplain who has spent 10 months in Iraq and will be returning to the war zone soon. The battlefield cliche is that there are no atheists in foxholes. Have you found that soldiers who come to war without any strong religious beliefs take more of an interest in spirituality?
Absolutely. Whether somebody has a strong religious tradition or someone has almost nothing, almost everyone begins asking the questions. What's the meaning, the purpose of my life? you know, is there a God? Does he care? How do I get connected with God? So, for example, I've baptized a lot of individuals, much more so in the range between, you know, maybe 19 to 25 year olds than I would have done as a pastor in Chicago.
Do you ever find that some soldiers who have had a religious background, when they get to a war zone and are surrounded by cruelty and carnage, lose their faith?
I think lots of folks ask, you know, where in the world is God in the midst of this? And that's a absolutely legitimate question. You know, you look for good when confronted with devastation, destruction, and death, and you look for good and you look for it, and some days you'll go weeks without seeing any. And I think guys ask that question frequently. And then I try to remind them, you know, what's going on in your life? Describe it. And then, you know, maybe it's a soldier that's been kind of adopted an Iraqi family and looked out for their kids, you know, said, well, look, the presence of God is in those kids, and you're making a difference in their lives. It's a matter of pointing out maybe some of the more subtle signs of hope in the midst of something that can be pretty bleak.
One of the things that must be difficult for you to do is to administer last rites to a soldier who has been wounded.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. It's very difficult. You know, when we first came to the section of Iraq, Ramadi, it was considered by many the most dangerous city on the face of the earth. We would have mass casualties two or three times a week, with the in-between days being filled in with, you know, soldiers, civilians being wounded and so forth. But you'd have mass casualty of 20, 30 people dead, 50 people wounded or so, just all the time, and it became normative. But when soldiers were critically wounded, and no matter how frequently you see it, it always grabs at your heart. You realize, you know, hey, this kid—he's 19 years old, he's 20 years old, and he's never going to see his parents again. You know, this is going to be his last day on the face of the earth. It's just a painful, difficult thing to do. In some ways, it's very beautiful. I mean, it's the most beautiful thing you can do is to just reassure them of God's love, God's care, God's compassion at the time in their life where they need it most. So it's beautiful, but it's difficult.
It must be hard to appreciate the beauty at that moment.
Oh yeah, you have to do that on reflection. You know, you try to be there with the person. If it's holding his hand, if it's stroking his forehead, you try to provide comforting words for him, a smile, whatever it is that you can. But it's difficult.
And because of what you do, are you somebody who rushes to the scene of every mass casualty event? Or
right, right. As long as I'm on the FOB, the forward operating base, I'll go to Charlie Med, the hospital. You know, obviously I can't do that if I'm out at the different combat outposts. But right, any mass casualty, we head directly down to Charlie Med. Now, if it's a mass casualty, and frequently what happens now, more often than not, is it involves exclusively Iraqi civilians or Iraqi police and army. In which case, you know, I'll be present there, but I certainly want to respect their Islamic traditions. So I don't, obviously I don't offer any particular Christian rites, but I'll hold their hand, smile, maybe talk to them through an interpreter. If some of them have been mortally wounded, I'll be with them, you know, as they die, just so they have somebody there.
You know, I know from looking at some of the dispatches that you've written about your experience that there is a ritual that accompanies the transportation of bodies of servicemen back to the United States. Can you describe that?
Oh, yes. We call them hero flights. So if a soldier has been killed, their bodies will be taken to a morgue, depending on where it can be, a kind of a makeshift building. And within that, the body's then prepared, at least somewhat, for helicopter flight that will take the remains to Kuwait, and then from Kuwait to Dover Air Force Base in the States. So when it's a soldier's been killed and is we're making arrangements for his hero flight, We'll put the body into the body bag, kind of go through the pockets and for identification, for personal belongings, personal effects, to make sure that it's recorded so that it travels with him. We'll then transfer the body onto a litter. There's an American flag with a light that's shining on it in the back of the morgue. About 20 minutes before the helicopter arrives, we'll have his closest friends, his buddies, we'll invite them into the morgue. We'll say a prayer. Then we'll ask the guys to line up and to be his litter bearers. And there's usually, you know, anywhere 50, 100, 200 soldiers that will be lining the path to the ambulance. Once the body is taken to the ambulance, I'll say another prayer for everyone gathered, and then we'll slowly process to the helipad. We open up the doors to the ambulance. His buddies once again will carry his remains and load him onto the helicopter. There's a final salute, and as the helicopter takes off, it's really touching and powerful and beautiful and painful all at once.
You know, I have to say, I can hear the emotion in your voice as you relive
this. As I'm talking about this, I'm replaying, you know, the event that I've experienced over and over again. And I do get a little choked up.
In this job as an Army chaplain, I mean, you are helping these troops with, you know, they're experiencing fear and stress and loneliness and often the pain of loss. And yet you're facing all that same stuff, too. Where do you turn for support and comfort?
You know, I've got some great friends that I've made since being deployed. Some other chaplains. There are a couple of priest friends back in the Chicagoland area that I email regularly, and I do that consciously for my own sanity. Because you're right, you know, I do experience most everything. You know, all the other guys are experiencing, and I certainly have to go somewhere with it, and it has to be, you know, safe. It has to be appropriate, and so I do have those channels, and I take advantage of it because it's important. And, you know, when times are stressful, I need that as much as any of the other soldiers.
And I wonder if in some ways it might be harder because you're carrying a piece of their pain with you as well as your own.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true. Anything that goes on in a soldier's life, I guess clinically it'd be ideal if you could completely separate yourself and look at somebody objectively. But, you know, these are the guys that you serve with. These are the guys you have meals with. These are the guys you joke around with. These are the guys you walk through all sorts of different experiences of their lives and your life, and you do this together. And so when they're hurting, it does become, the chaplain's pain too.
I wondered if I could ask you to kind of focus on a couple of moments, and if you can think of them, that'll be helpful. And if you can't, I would understand. But maybe one moment that tells us what's hard about your role, and maybe another that tells us what's rewarding about it.
Both hard and rewarding. Those are great questions. There was an interesting experience in the Al Anbar province where I'm stationed. There has been a dramatic improvement in terms of the security situation, and that took place not so much because of the U.S. Armed Forces, but because the local sheikhs have banded together and decided to take back their province. And they formed a council called the Anbar Awakening. The head of that was a Sheikh Abu Risa, and he was kind of the charismatic leader of this group. Just recently, about, I guess, 6 weeks, maybe 2 months ago, he was killed in an attack, a car bomb attack. Now, he lived just outside of our base. And so when the explosion took place, of course, we all saw it. It was, you know, it was one of the smaller explosions. And any time that happened, you know, you wonder, well, who just died? But having lost him, when we found out that it was him, it was, you know, it was hard because, you know, here's a guy who's, if this thing in Iraq works, it's going to be largely because of his willingness to take a gamble, his willingness to offer leadership. You know, it's in some extent, it's being duplicated in different areas of Iraq now. And it would be almost the equivalent for the United States of losing a founding father. And actually, in a lot of ways, I think, you know, I'm still alive largely because of the stance this guy took. With the amount of violence that was taking place, there's no way that I could do as much, the traveling, the amount of traveling that I've done without being seriously wounded or killed. You know, if I was, you know, hit by a IED 2 weeks into it, you know, you're not going to make it through a 15-month deployment without serious injury or being killed. You know, so his death, I think, was something that I took hard because he's done so much for the people of Iraq, and it's a sign of hope. So that's one piece I'd say that maybe in an unusual way that's difficult.
We're speaking with Father John Barkmeyer. He's just finished 10 months as an army chaplain in Iraq. He'll be returning soon to the war zone. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Speaking with Father John Barkmeyer, he's just finished 10 months in Iraq as an army chaplain and will be returning to Iraq soon. You've described how you have these encounters with soldiers who really need help and support and counseling. I'm wondering, farther up the chain of command, what do commanders think of you and your fellow chaplains?
Well, time and time again, you know, they'll express their gratitude because in one way, we keep a lot of bad things off their plate. You know, by being able to deal with things on our level, we deal with a lot of situations that they never become aware of. So if things are running smoothly, you know, if something's happening, you know, chances are a lot of, you know, crises have been averted. You know, people are finding successful ways of dealing with the different challenges in their lives. But I've been very, very impressed with the support from the commanders. And that's
if
really
I can
been
ask,
across the board.
Yeah, what kinds of crisis do you avert? What kinds of problems do you save them?
Well, you know, here's a typical example that's just devastating for a soldier. Their spouse back home is cheating on them. Well, you think of what happens. They're 7,000 miles away. They are powerless. They can't go back home. They can't fix anything. You know, their vows of marriage have been shattered. They're devastated, you know, and the next day they got to go back out on mission. You know, they got to put their life on the line. They've got to be aware. They got to be alert, not only to keep them alive, but to keep their buddies alive, you know. And so they got some real significant demands that are placed on them. Their head's not in the game. You know, how could they be? And this happens much more frequently than I would have ever imagined. So those types of things, you know, you work with somebody. You let them talk through it. You give them some coping strategies. And in a sense, you try to patch them up so they can go out and do their job tomorrow, because regardless, they're going to have to go out and do their job tomorrow. You know, there's in the Army, you don't get a day off, you don't get breaks. The expectation is you have to show up because chances are there's nobody to take your place. So those types of things, you know, that would be a very typical role, something that a chaplain would do regularly, especially in a deployed environment.
You know, you said earlier that you went into the military ministry in part because so many people from your own parish had gone to serve. I don't know if you're comfortable answering this question, but I wonder how you feel about the war.
Well, you know, publicly, probably 2 weeks or 3 weeks before the initial invasion, you know, at Mass during the homily, you know, I said, I made three points, two of which I said, you know, looking at the what's offered as intelligence for the existence of weapons of mass destruction, I said, it does not look credible, you know, especially to justify, you know, an invasion. I also said another thing that's being touted is the connection to Al-Qaeda. But the evidence that's being presented is flimsy at best and certainly something that you can't justify, you know, launching an invasion for. And so, my feelings have been pretty consistent throughout in terms of getting into the war. I think, my role as a chaplain, I guess it doesn't matter why we're in war, because my role is taking care of the guys. So regardless of my personal feelings, I'm there for the soldiers. That's what I do. I've certainly had, lots of questions every day, that I'm serving, and especially serving, overseas in Iraq. I also realize now, as much as I do believe we have to begin a slow, carefully planned withdrawal to give Iraqis ownership, and realize this is their country, the problems ultimately are going to have to be solved by them. So I do believe we do have to begin a phased withdrawal. But we are now, we're morally responsible for what happened. We created this situation. And as much as I'd like to pull everybody out today, morally, I just don't think we can. We have to continue to work, with the situation to give the people of Iraq the best possible chance of salvaging their country and salvaging their lives.
Well, Father Barkmeyer, I wish you a safe tour when you return to Iraq, and I want to thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Father John Barkmeyer is an Army chaplain. He returned to Iraq today to complete his 15-month tour of duty. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhevar, and Joan Tui Westman. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. And from Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs creating a greener tomorrow, on the web at kauffman.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, golf's bad boy, John Daly. He doesn't have an exercise regimen. He begins his day with a Diet Coke and a cigarette and has battled addictions to alcohol and gambling. But he sure can play. He's won two of golf's most prestigious tournaments. He has a memoir and a new book called Golf My Own Damn Way. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.